dedicated to the survival of American democracy in an increasingly dangerous world, this is Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney, acted as Assistant Secretary of Defense for International Security Policy under President Ronald Reagan, founder of the Center for Security Policy in Washington, D.C., the go-to man for defense and foreign policy issues, joined by the greatest minds in the security policy business, the special forces in the War of Ideas at Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.
Welcome to Secure Freedom Radio. This is Frank Gaffney, your host and guide for what I think of as an intelligence briefing on the war for the free world. A woman who has, well, forgotten more about the war for the free world than most of us will ever know is our first guest. She is Claudia Rosette, a world-class investigative reporter, having spent years on the beat in places like, well, Russia and China, as well as monitoring the UN, notably for the Wall Street Journal. These days, she is a senior fellow with the Independent Women's Forum and columnist for PJ Media. We're always delighted to have her with us. Claudia, welcome back. It's good to have you.
Thank you. Thanks, Frank. Great to be here.
You had a piece the other day that caught my eye about the 10-year anniversary of Barack Obama's Russia reset. And again, it's just one of those wonderful pieces where you bring your corporate memory to bear on current events. And I just wanted to give you an opportunity to talk a little bit about what we did in the course of the, particularly the Obama era, and what to some extent we're still doing vis-a-vis the Russians that has greatly contributed to the problem we face from them.
Sure. Well, cast your mind all the way back to the collapse of the Soviet Union for just a minute, and that where we had a decade, more or less, of Boris Yeltsin and great concern in Washington and the West about how do we sort of rehabilitate Russia after this, after the more than 70 years of the Soviet Union and communism. And when I was working there in the mid-90s, everybody was in a great fuss over how do we help Russia? And this has really not worked out so well. You know, part of in countries where we really won, we completely defeated the hostile powers in Germany and Japan, World War II. They're now democracies and our friends. In Russia, what you had instead was the old order was never really gone. It's sort of Soviet Union collapsed, but you then began the rise of this dictatorship under Vladimir Putin, who was installed, to whom Yeltsin turned over power on New Year's Eve 1999. Welcome to the new millennium. And it was obvious to some of us right away that there were real problems here. But for instance, by 2006, you had the poisoning with polonium, radioactive polonium 210. Of a former Russian agent in London, Alexander Litvinenko, who died just horribly. And then came in 2008, Putin launched a war in the neighboring country of Georgia, one of the former Soviet republics, but independent now. And that's where things were when, as President Bush was leaving office at the end of his second term, President Obama was coming in. It was a moment when the United States, as superpower and leader of the free world, should have drawn a line, a real line. You don't cross this. You don't do any more of this. Instead, what President Obama did was send this sort of incredibly juvenile, foolish gesture, Hillary Clinton bearing a big red plastic button to symbolize a reset of relations. And the ceremony itself was just mortifying. Among other things, the State Department mislabeled the button with the Russian word for overcharge, not reset. Even that was wrong. But the bigger problem was the reset wasn't just symbolic. It was something where the immediate gift, the real gift, was that President Obama reneged on the Bush promises of missile defense systems for Eastern Europe, which is what Putin wanted. It was a gift to Vladimir Putin. And it was the beginning of this series of what became the sort of accelerating series of concessions during Obama's two terms, where by the end of his time in office, you had a dramatically, not just emboldened Vladimir Putin, who was always going to be looking for any advantage he could get, but he had been handed one thing after another. You know, the sort of one of the signal moments, there are milestones along this road. One of the signal moments was President Obama caught on that open microphone during the 2012 presidential election campaign, promising Dmitry Medvedev, who was then officially the president of Russia. Vladimir Putin was then officially the prime minister, although it was a sort of cosmetic do-si-do to escape, get around Russian term limits on the presidency. Everyone knew that Putin was still in charge. President Obama certainly knew it. He was telling Medvedev, I'll have more flexibility after the election, to which Medvedev replied, I will transmit this information to Vladimir. I mean, it was out of a bad spy movie. And then came the series of events where things really began to head fast in the wrong direction. The Edward Snowden, the rogue intelligence contractor running off and getting asylum in Russia with basically the National Security Agent playbook. And right around that time, President Obama began erasing the red line he'd drawn over chemical weapons in Syria. And then, and this was quite fantastic, this was unbelievable at the time, because we were supposed to, U.S. was supposed to be full of protest over Snowden and the theft of our intelligence secrets. President Obama basically invited Vladimir Putin into Syria to oversee, to help the Organization for the Prohibition of Chemical Weapons oversee the erstwhile, the promised chemical weapons disarmament of the Assad regime in Syria. We know how that went. Instead, Russia became a mainstay of the Assad regime. The chemical weapons attacks continued. And then, of course, in 2014, Vladimir Putin went into Crimea, annexed it, seized it from Ukraine, this massive grab of territory in Eastern Europe. And still, President Obama officially protested and put on some sanctions, but Obama was so eager to keep Russia at the bargaining table for the terrible Iran nuclear deal, that nothing was done to actually reverse any of these things. There was no real line drawn. And finally, we get to the presidential election of 2016. And when President Trump, against expectations, I don't think the Russians expected him to win it any more than the Washington establishment did, but he won. And then the Obama administration flips around, and now you're here. Then you start hearing that Russia is the most demonic force on the planet and that Trump is working with them and so on. And that kind of brings us to the current era.
Claudia Rosette, this was an extraordinarily important litany of examples of a miscarriage that, you know, we are haunted by even to this date. Claudia Rosette, thank you so much for the work you're doing at the Independent Women's Forum at PJ Media, and of course with us from time to time. Come back to us again very soon if you would. Next up, we will speak with Gordon Chang about developments on the China front, including the so-called trade deal. That and more straight ahead.
Visit us at facebook.com/securefreedom with Frank Gaffney. You're listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney from the nation's capital in Washington, D.C.
We're back. We're joined by Gordon Chang, a man who graces this audience and microphones each week. I'm very grateful for that. He is, of course, one of the country's preeminent experts on Asia, and most especially what communist China is up to and what it might mean for us. Gordon is the author of two terrific books, actually now three terrific books, one on the coming collapse of China, another nuclear showdown North Korea takes on the world, and the third entitled Losing South Korea. You see Gordon on Fox and other outlets very regularly. We're always pleased he's at ours. Gordon, it's good to have you back. Welcome.
Thank you so much, Frank.
So, Gordon, let us talk about the trade deal, we are told, is either off or is coming, depending on who you're listening to. There are now reports out of China, particularly, that in addition to the possible coming to terms on the amount of products that the Chinese will buy from the United States, goods and services, I guess, over $1 trillion worth, and the possibility that they will take some sort of steps to make it illegal for them to steal our intellectual property. There's also some sort of currency promise coming as well. What do you make of all of this? First of all, is it in the offing? And second of all, will it amount to a hill of beans?
Most people do think there will be a trade agreement of some sort. And it's really difficult to understand what's going on. Largely, we have to look back at what happened with President Trump in Hanoi, where most people were saying that the president was going to agree to some arrangement with Kim Jong-un because he felt pressure to make concessions. And of course, as we know, President Trump walked away. And that was a really good thing, showing Kim Jong-un that the United States can't be bullied. And he also showed the Chinese that. So if we look at the trade talk right now, where virtually everyone is saying there will be some sort of arrangement, you know, there could be or there might not be. You know, with regard to the various elements, these rumors about what the scope of a trade deal looks like look extremely disadvantageous to the United States. And so I hope that President Trump does what he did in Hanoi, walks away from Xi Jinping and a trade deal which is not in our interest.
Well, let me just drill down on that, Gordon. It would seem on the face of it that if the Chinese are promising to buy $1 trillion worth of our stuff and they're enacting into law a ban on stealing our intellectual property and they're going to not allow the devaluation of the yuan for purposes of offsetting tariffs or other advantage, that would all be a very good thing. What's wrong with this picture?
There's almost everything wrong with this picture. So, for instance, with regard to the talk about buying U.S. products, we got to remember that both China and the United States are members of the World Trade Organization. And one member of the WTO cannot offer a deal to another member of the WTO without offering it to every other member. So, for instance, there have been discussions about buying $1.2 trillion worth of U.S. goods over the course of 6 years. Well, China has to offer that to everybody. So that's a commitment to buy $195.6 trillion worth of goods over 6 years. That's just ridiculous. This is a violation of the non-discrimination provision, which is at the core of the WTO. So China in about 6 months is going to say to the U.S., oh, sorry, we forgot about the non-discrimination rule. We can't honor our promise to you.
Well, it wouldn't be the first time that they violated WTO rules, though, would it, Gordon? But it doesn't seem likely that they're going to in this fashion, that's for sure.
I mean, Frank, we could go through every element of the proposed deal, and there are objections to them. And also, there's another thing that we need to point out, and that is Mike Pillsbury has been reporting that the U.S. has agreed to at least two very important concessions to the Chinese. One of them is to allow them to bid on U.S. infrastructure. The second is even more alarming, and that is allowing the Chinese into the electronic payment system in the U.S. That would be Alibaba's Alipay. And just allowing them into the financial backbone is something that we cannot permit. So, Frank, there's almost nothing good about these proposed terms that have been floated in the last several months.
And that's altogether in addition to the fact that, as you've made on this program, among other places, Gordon, very clear, they don't honor their promises. So it would be a complete pig in a poke, including these downside risks, as you say, of the concessions that are apparently being offered by the United States. I walk away, it seems to me, is exactly right. Gordon, I have to move along. Let me just ask you about the Chinese seemingly ratcheting up their aggressive behavior in the South China Sea, not so much with respect to us, I guess. Well, that's been going on for some time, but I understand they're ramming and sinking fishing boats from other nations in the region, and they've glommed onto or are beginning at least to exercise control over yet another shoal strategically located near the Philippines. Talk about those.
Yeah, this is another Scarborough Shoal incident. And it's, again, the Chinese using what they call their cabbage strategy to basically prevent Philippine fishing boats from approaching a shoal called Tithu. And clearly this is another instance of aggression. We've been talking about how we're going to honor our mutual defense treaty to the Philippines, and a lot of people in the Philippines don't trust our word. Well, yeah, they probably shouldn't after Scarborough Shoal. This is a chance for the United States to redeem its pledge to the Philippines to restore our credibility and to finally stop Chinese aggression. Now, yeah, this is going to be dangerous. People will say that, but it's no more dangerous and certainly a lot less dangerous than confirming to the Chinese that there is no pushback to their aggressive expansionary moves in the South China Sea. This is like the 1930s, where you have one incident after another where Britain and France refused to take effective action against the Third Reich. And we know how that ended up. This is exactly the same dynamic, except we're the Britain and France.
Right. And, you know, you mentioned that Secretary of State Mike Pompeo did rather forthrightly last week make known to the Filipinos and presumably the Chinese and others that we would stand up to them. So this is the place where it must be done, it seems. Gordon, just if you could help unpack the term cabbage strategy. What do they mean by that and why is it apt?
Cabbage strategy is one where the Chinese flood a particular area with their vessels, with layers of vessels, which is the reason why the name cabbage, like leaves of cabbage. And they've successfully employed this, of course, at Scarborough Shoal. They've done this at Second Thomas Shoal. All of these are thought to be features of the Philippines, much closer to the Philippine archipelago than they are to any recognized Chinese feature. And so it is a replay of a story which we have seen so many times.
Yeah. And strategically of great moment, because especially to the extent that we will be operating from the Philippines again, the ability to project power against our vessels, as well as the Philippines' sovereignty and so on, is a very serious challenge indeed. Gordon, let me finally turn to North Korea. You have written, of course, about the North Koreans and the nuclear showdown that they've been engaged in. There is evidently now irrefutable evidence that the North Koreans are resuming some of the activities that or preparing to, it would seem, at least resume some of the missile and nuclear testing activities that we've seen them suspend. How serious a problem would that be were they to go back into that business? And what is the administration saying about it, notably John Bolton?
Yeah, there are reports that North Korea is going back and rebuilding parts of its Sohae satellite launch facility, which is at Tongchung-ri. This is to launch rockets. Also, at a missile facility, Sanam-dong, there is more activity. So this is both missiles and rockets, and the administration has reminded the North Koreans that we have more leverage than they do. And this was from National Security Advisor Bolton in the last few hours. The question is whether we're actually going to do something. President Trump has said he would be very disappointed if they did. As you say, there's irrefutable evidence that they are now doing so. So it's up to the president to actually make good on his words. And we'll just have to see whether the president can pivot or not. And that's not entirely clear to me.
Yep, me either. I mentioned nuclear testing. I guess that's not yet among the mix of things that they've started ratcheting up again, as far as we can tell.
Well, we do know, and this was clear at the time of the June summit in Singapore last year, that they have increased their production of fissile material. And that has continued throughout the 9 months or so since that time. But of course, they have not detonated a nuclear device since their thermonuclear detonation in September of 2017.
There's some speculation that that's principally because they, not only this romancing of Donald Trump, but they've so badly damaged their nuclear test facilities and underground caverns and so on in which they were doing their testing that they've got to find someplace else to do it. And so we'll be, I'm afraid, confronting that prospect in the not-too-distant future and perhaps be surprised by it. Gordon, finally, there is some talk that the president is willing to have yet another summit with Kim Jong-un, notwithstanding this sort of thing. What book do you make on that?
Yeah, I don't think there's going to be a third summit between President Trump and Kim Jong-un anytime in the near future. I think the president understands would be a political liability for him, especially since he has not gotten the North Koreans to stop some dangerous activities, as we've just discussed. So although some people talk about it as relatively soon, my sense, and of course this is just my sense, is that we won't see that for many months. I don't think we'll see it until the end of this year at the earliest.
Gordon, we have to leave it at that for the moment. Thank you so much for your time today, as well as for the great work you do at The Daily Beast and National Interest and Fox News and elsewhere, as an addition to your visits with us. We're very grateful for them. Keep up the good work, my friend. Next up, we will speak with Fred Flights of the Center for Security Policy. Straight ahead.
Now more with Frank Gaffney.
Welcome back. We're joined by Fred Flights, the president and CEO of the Center for Security Policy, who has spent his life basically working on intelligence matters and the security of the United States. He's served in the Central Intelligence Agency for the better part of 20 years. He was on the staff of John Bolton as his chief of staff at the State Department and most recently at the National Security Council, and also served on the House Intelligence Committee, a man of many parts, and it's always a delight to be able to pick his brains about things that are happening. Fred, welcome back. Good to have you.
Good to be here, Frank.
We were talking, Gordon Chang and I, in our previous segment, about North Korea, and few people have followed these Kims and the dynasty that they've been operating in North Korea to the great detriment of the North Korean people than you have, Fred, over these many years. Particularly, you have been one of the country's duty experts on the kinds of things they're doing in the weapons of mass destruction space. There are now reports that Kim of the current administration, that is to say Kim Jong-un, is actively beavering away again on some of the activities that President Trump has taken heart from as he sought a denuclearization agreement with them. Let's talk a little bit about what we know and what you make of it.
Well, I'm glad to discuss this because my friend Gordon Chang and I have slightly different perspectives on this. So far, I think the president's policy on North Korea has been quite successful. He did get a halt in the nuclear and missile tests, and there are a variety of experts who believe that the halt in the missile tests is significantly setting back the North Korean missile program, and I think it's setting back the nuclear program, too. I'm not saying there isn't activities going on underground or indoors, but they have to do these tests to perfect their technology. Recently, there have been some reports based on satellite imagery suggesting that a particular missile site, there's activity there indicating that the North Koreans may be preparing a missile launch. I'm very skeptical about that, Frank. There's always activities at these sites, and I have watched report after report by Washington think tanks saying they've seen something in satellite imagery indicating North Korea is going to do something, and they were wrong. I'm waiting for confirmation by the U.S. government, particularly the CIA, because I got to tell you, reports by these think tanks are usually wrong. If the North Koreans are planning to do this, I think it would be extremely provocative, and there should be a significant ramp up in sanctions. But I'm not getting as excited about this as other experts because I don't know that these reports are true.
Yeah, well, that's a fair point. And if it's not true, all the better. If it is true, or if, as you say, Fred Flights, there's almost certainly activity going on underground and out of sight of satellites, commercial or otherwise, there would be reason to be concerned that the North Koreans are still very much in this business. Gordon mentioned that they're still producing, you know, the feedstock of nuclear weapons, fissile material. How concerned are you that, notwithstanding, you know, the suspension for the moment at least of these tests of missiles and nuclear weapons, that the underlying nuclear capabilities of North Korea are still a building?
They may be developing, but I think North Korea already has between 40 and 60 nuclear weapons. If the program continues, they're going to have more. They already have too many. They already have missiles that probably can hit the U.S. mainland. The question is to get the North Korean leader to walk through the door that President Trump has opened to him, the denuclearization door, and he hasn't chosen to do that yet. And he tried to push for what would have been a bad deal at the Vietnam summit. So, I mean, you know, I don't doubt that these activities are continuing, and that makes a bad situation worse, but the situation would be bad even if they weren't continuing.
Well, it's true. I guess compared to what is the question. The case for denuclearizing the place is, I think, though, compelling and should be pursued aggressively. Let me ask you about one other piece of this. A colleague of ours, Dr. Peter Vincent Pry, has for some time been warning, as I think you know, Fred, about the possibility that the North Koreans may have put a couple of those nuclear weapons on satellites that they have orbiting the globe, including overflying the United States with regularity. Peter is, of course, one of the country's preeminent experts on this phenomenon of electromagnetic pulse. And he's reported, as has the Congressional EMP Threat Commission that he served on for many years, that the North Koreans may have obtained from the Russians super EMP weapons designs. And were those to be the configuration of the weapons that were aboard these satellites, could pose really an existential threat to this country. Do you have any thoughts on this as to whether that seems plausible or even likely?
Well, I cited the reports in my 2018 book, The Coming North Korean Nuclear Nightmare, published by the Center for Security Policy. You can get it on securefreedom.org, about the super EMP designs that the North Koreans may have acquired from the Russians, and Pry might be right about that. I hope that he's not right. I know that former CIA Director Jim Woolsey agrees with Dr. Pry that the North Koreans may have placed nuclear warheads in satellites to detonate over foreign targets. I'm frankly not convinced of that. I don't think the North Koreans have the technical capability to do that. But look, in the area of weapons of mass destruction, many of us have been wrong many times. So I can see that Pry and Woolsey, he might be right, but that's not where I am.
Yeah. Well, as you say, let's hope they're not. I think they would be just as happy to be wrong as well, but I fear they may be. Fred, I want to switch gears. Since we last talked, the House of Representatives has adopted a resolution on a bipartisan basis, I think it must be said, that condemned, in a fashion, anti-Semitism, did not mention Ilhan Omar, a woman who has been widely recognized as having engaged in some of that anti-Semitic rhetoric, at least. But it also denounced other kinds of hatefulness and bigotry and the like, which Ilhan Omar claimed was a great victory for her, because among them, specifically mentioned, was Islamophobia. Give us a sense, Fred. You've been tracking and writing about and expressing real concern about this rising tide of anti-Semitism, of which she is just one manifestation, Ilhan Omar. But what did you make of this resolution, and what does it say about the congressional leadership in the House of Representatives under Nancy Pelosi?
It's extremely worrisome, Frank. The Center for Security Policy is taking a strong stand right now on growing anti-Semitism on the left and in the Democrat Party. This isn't just criticism of the Israeli government or Netanyahu. This is rhetoric that is repeating ancient anti-Jewish tropes, Jewish money in politics, that the state of Israel doesn't have a right to exist, that shouldn't exist. This is what Omar is pushing. This is clear. This is something that should be clearly opposed. I'm very proud of Congressman, like Congressman Elliot Engel, the chairman of the House Foreign Affairs Committee, who said this is anti-Semitism and demanded that it be denounced by the House. And House Democratic leaders did not have the courage to speak out against this clear anti-Semitism by one of their members. And what worries me, Frank, this is a growing trend on the left and the Democratic Party that is starting to take over the Democratic Party. And when they were incapable of doing something so simple as denouncing clear anti-Semitic statements by one of their members, I got to tell you, I worry for our country.
Yeah. I specifically think there's ample reason for worrying because, as we've seen most recently in the United Kingdom, where sort of the counterpart to the Democratic Party there, the Labour Party, has essentially become a creature of a very anti-Semitic leader, Jeremy Corbyn. So this trajectory is one that's been mapped, and God help us if it's taking hold in our country as well, at the level of one of the two major political parties, no less.
I think we're moving in that direction. It really worries me.
Well, I think so too, and I commend you and your leadership at the Center for Security Policy in opposing this, which was manifested, by the way, recently in a joint letter that you signed calling for Ilhan Omar. I keep wanting to call her Mullah Omar or Mulan Omar because it seems as though she's got some of those attributes of these characters. But I wanted to just ask you, Fred, you have called, among others, for her removal from the House Foreign Affairs Committee on the basis of this kind of conduct. Tell us why that's important as you see it and warranted.
The Foreign Affairs Committee is one of the most prestigious committees in the House of Representatives, and it oversees U.S. foreign policy. It has to pass resolutions on how America deals with every country on earth, including the state of Israel. And to have someone who hates Israel and has said statements basically that Israel should not exist, statements that are clearly anti-Semitic, on this committee is a recipe for chaos. What was Nancy Pelosi thinking when she put a person like this on this committee? I'm not condemning her because she's Muslim. That's fine. We need a diverse Congress. The Democrats want that. Great. We can learn from other people, other experiences. But I don't welcome her because of her anti-Semitism and hatred of Israel. And the fact that Pelosi would do this, it just shows there's simply no leadership at all. That she really has, she's sold out to these far leftists with all their energy, with all this, these new ideas of socialism they're bringing to the Democratic Party. They're also bringing anti-Semitism and hatred of Israel. And Pelosi should be ashamed of herself for giving in to them.
Yeah. Amen to that. And it does seem to me that her removal from the Foreign Affairs Committee is important. We'll be talking momentarily with Robert Charles about the problem of access to highly classified information that she also enjoys in part as a result of that service that it seems to me is another reason for very serious concern here. Fred Fleiss, we have to leave it at that for the moment, though. This is always a welcome part of our program. We so appreciate your visits each week, and we look forward to talking with you again next. We'll talk with Robert Charles, former Assistant Secretary of State, about the border and, well, clearances, among other things, right after this.
Go to SecureFreedomRadio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio. Go to SecureFreedomRadio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio.
Welcome back. We have Robert Charles, a regular here at Secure Freedom Radio, back with us, I'm very pleased to say. Robert is a former Assistant Secretary of State in the George W. Bush administration. He also served in the Reagan and George H.W. Bush White Houses. He has taught law at Harvard. He is an attorney by training, but a man of many parts whose expertise we are always pleased to be able to mine. Robert, welcome back. Good to have you with us.
Thank you, Frank, very much.
We have today the budget that President Trump wants the Congress to enact coming forward. The details on many aspects are, as we speak, not yet known, but one that has been telegraphed is the $8.7, I believe it is, $1 billion that he is seeking in this coming fiscal year to complete the construction of the wall in 17 places that the Department of Homeland Security has identified as particularly problematic in terms of people bringing stuff and others across the border. You at the State Department had responsibility specifically for the narcotics trafficking and had a lot to do with trying to enhance border security in the face of what was coming across the border in that regard. Robert, tell us a little bit about the importance that we should attach to the president getting this additional funding and completing the construction of the physical barriers, at least along these high traffic areas.
Yeah, Frank, I think it goes to the fact that truth will not change, that you can step on it, as Churchill said, turn away from it, deny it, and it remains what it is. And I think average Americans and smart, thoughtful leaders, as well as listeners here on this show, just should know that this is a true, real threat to the integrity of the United States. It is a true, real threat to the sovereignty of the United States. And the sovereign threat comes from transiting that border every day are between 1,100 and 2,000, even at a low point now, of illegal aliens. They are seeking for either economic or other purposes to get in here. You have the drug trafficking organizations who have penetrated every corridor of the corridors that we had defined. They are clearly looking for the weaknesses in the border. They find them if they can get around them. They do if they have to. You know, what we get out of the wall, of course, is that we slow them down. Our high technology is able, ground, air, space, to see what's happening and be able to integrate a solution to it, an end game that stops as many of them as we can. And then the drug piece is just enormous. I don't know how to emphasize in any more simple way than saying it, that virtually all of the major drugs that are creating the problem in the United States today, the synthetics, the fentanyl, the heroin, foreign source heroin, because we don't grow heroin poppies in this country, and the foreign source cocaine, coca is not grown in this country, all come across that border or through a maritime corridor. And so the reality is that for the average American, their public health and their public safety, never mind, by the way, high purity marijuana also coming out of Mexico. But, you know, the average person's public health and public safety is directly affected by whether you protect both the ports of entry and what lies between the ports of entry. The only ways you can do that is through high technology and physical barriers. The president is speaking the truth. I think it's unfortunate that in this political chaos moment, people are being told to look away from the truth, because, you know, honestly, even $8 billion or $9 billion in a $4 trillion federal budget is nothing and is not sufficient to fully warrant, to fully protect that border. You really need probably in the range of $30 billion to do a proper job. But, you know, right now we're in the moment where people speak untruths as if they were truths. They get repeated by the media, and people are sort of told to look away from this fact. And I would encourage people to keep their eyes on it.
Yeah. Well, I always think immediately, as you say that, of the big lie. You know, it doesn't change the fact that it's a lie, that it is endlessly repeated, and it just has the very, very destructive effect of being accepted when that repetition takes place.
The more that people are deluged by rapid-fire electronic reproduction of the big lie, I think the more they need to just shake it loose and think for themselves. Think, use common sense. Because common sense tells you you've shut your own front door, you certainly want to protect your border. And that's common sense.
Yeah. Well, it is common sense. Unfortunately, it seems it's in shorter and shorter supply these days. Robert, let me switch gears. You mentioned fentanyl. There was a stunning statement by the Secretary of Homeland Security last week, Kirstjen Nielsen, about the quantities of this stuff and the lethality of it. She said, as I recall, that there's enough coming into this country to kill every American twice over. You've talked with me on the program before about the dangers of this particular narcotic, but this really brought it home to me in terms of the magnitude of the problem. Would you elaborate?
Yes. You know, what you're pointing out, or what she is pointing out, is that both in terms of quantity and purity, fentanyl is extremely dangerous. And there is a corollary to it called carfentanil, which is even more dangerous, believe it or not. So dangerous you can't touch it. And of course, this presents tremendous problems for American law enforcement at the local, state, federal levels. And it reinforces the significance of trying to turn the volume down on all of these drugs, not least fentanyl, which are foreign source. Again, as we mentioned a moment ago, the vast majority, although unfortunately we have those who promote drug abuse in the United States by by promoting marijuana, but the vast majority of marijuana, cocaine, heroin, and fentanyl, as well as other synthetics, methamphetamines, come from the outside. Fentanyl is not only the precursors, but the actual drug comes from about 600 producers in China. And one of the things you could argue right now is that, and she's exactly right, by the way, and it gets in through the Postal Service, it gets in through international air traffic, it also gets in across the southern border, particularly, it doesn't come from sort of Central America through Mexico, it comes into Mexico and then from Mexico on up. But the truth be told, China ought to be held to account here, and one of the things I have suggested to others, including those in the government, is that they could put a codicil on this trade agreement that says, and as a communist country who could crack down on anything they want, that's one of the great joys of authoritarian, totalitarian governments, you can crack down on those 600 producers and you can prevent that fentanyl and carfentanyl and other synthetics from getting into the United States. And we expect you to do that, or there will be penalties.
Well, the other possible explanation for why this is happening is, of course, that this is very much consistent with the desires of the Chinese government, and it's another of their unrestricted warfare angles of attack on this country. I don't think it's happening by accident, and I think they know full well what the consequences of it are, but holding them accountable for it certainly seems to me to make sense.
You're absolutely right, Frank, and it may seem far-fetched to people that war would stretch to that kind of an asymmetric attack. But in fact, Khrushchev in the 1960s vocalized this exact idea that the drug abuse problem in the United States could be exploited in a way that would dramatically affect public health and safety in the United States, help to divide the country and make us a sicker and a more unsafe country. And I think you could make the argument, although Americans have fallen for this prey, or have fallen prey to this, that in fact the Chinese probably do know what they're doing. But that doesn't mean that we shouldn't hold their feet to the fire and try to reduce supply. The reason for that, incidentally, is that narcotics are just about the only consumer good that generate their own demand. So an increase in supply produces addiction, which produces an increase in demand, which increases supply. So you have to turn that cycle off at both ends, the demand end and the supply end.
Robert Charles, let me turn to another topic that you've recently written on, clearances. This is such an important issue, and we won't have time to do justice to it today, but just to start this conversation with you, in this piece that you wrote for AMAC.com, I believe it is, the magnitude of the problem that we have with people getting clearances who shouldn't have them, or getting access to classified information even without clearances, notably in the United States Congress, is a huge national security problem, is it not?
Yes. The first part you have here is tremendous hypocrisy on the part of the United States Congress. You have an oversight and a judiciary committee, which have issued now dozens of letters and threatened dozens of subpoenas of people on the basis that they believe that President Trump was insufficiently attentive to the idea of vetting and granting interim top secret TSI or SCI clearances to folks inside the White House, literally a handful of folks. It's ironic that they're undertaking this sort of so-called oversight hearing, because first of all, presidents have the authority. It's their legal authority. Clearances, the whole idea of a clearance comes from executive authority. It's done to protect information and to protect information from people that shouldn't see it.
Robert Charles, we have to leave it at that for the moment. Thank you so much for your time. I hope you'll come back to us again very soon, and the rest of you will do the same tomorrow. Same time, same station. Until then, this is Frank Gaffney. Thanks for listening.
You've been listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.